Hello, me again, Ian Montgomery, the guy that does the Challenger City podcast. Back with another interview. I'm really, really looking forward to you listening to this one because, well, I want to talk about bikes. Now, I spent a lot of time ranting and raving about bicycles and bike lanes over the past few weeks and months after Doug Ford's lunacy of ripping out bike lanes in Toronto. Anyway, I moved, so it doesn't really matter anymore. However, I really, really love talking to Chris because he's Canadian, although he's become Dutch, and he works with an organization called the Dutch Cycling Embassy, and they take some of the amazing things that the Netherlands has done around cycling infrastructure, and it's really not just bike lanes. There's a lot more to it than that. And then going around the world and showing cities how they don't need to become Amsterdam, but they can learn a lot of the best practices and principles of what works in the Netherlands and apply to other places that look and feel different, have different characteristics. I think it's a really important thing in here, but if we can design better cities for things like active travel and just being nicer places, of which cycling is a lovely activity, both to get to work, to go meet a friend, or just for a bit of exercise. If we can think about bikes differently, so they're not lost in that context of the middle-aged man in Lycra or the sort of bike courier who can sometimes be a bit obnoxious with how they ride, and actually think around, what does really great cycling infrastructure do to our cities? How does that change how we interact and interface with them? How does it change how we work? How does it change how we shop? How does it change how we do things with friends and whatnot? So I really wanted to talk to Chris, and very nice man. He said, yeah, absolutely, sure, let's book this in. So we'll go through a bit about him and his background and how he got to the Netherlands. We'll talk about the Dutch Cycling Embassy. We'll talk about where's doing it really well, where we can get excited about, and then like some of the things that cities just need to do to be able to start becoming places where it feels safe and fun to ride a bike, and how that doesn't necessarily increase traffic congestion. We can all be nicer and happier and healthier. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Chris Bruntler from the Dutch Cycling Embassy. Yeah, Chris, thank you so much for agreeing to have another chat with me about bikes. I really appreciate it. So like, as I did this second series, I want to go through like, who's really great as these sort of not necessarily traditional urbanists that now do amazing things to make cities better places to live, work, play, and like you're like very close to the top of my list for that, like doing what you do with the Dutch Cycling Embassy. But rather than me bastardizing an introduction to you, I'd love to get you just to talk a little bit about your story of how you went from lobbying for a bike lane in Vancouver to being the sort of global cycling advocate in the Netherlands.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Well, every time I share the story, I still kind of shake my head and wonder how it all fell into place. But, you know, it was just I am in a lot of ways a recovering architect, having trained as a residential designer and worked as one for many years, and dipped my toe inadvertently into the world of cycling advocacy in my early 30s as a young father and having a cycle commute from our home in East Vancouver to my architectural office in Granville and living car-free with our family to try and advocate for safer streets, for a better infrastructure, more everyday cycling for people in regular clothes and, those passion projects that my wife Melissa and I did on our evenings, on our weekends, the writing, the photography, the video production. These were all skills that we kind of honed in our free time, and over a course of 15 years, you know, ended up landing us ostensibly our dream jobs in the Netherlands. And, you know, it wasn't necessarily an overnight sensation or a product of any one single opportunity, but just a series of opportunities we created for ourselves through being passionate about making our city a better place. And the personal journey we went on through that period of time, and to not to belittle the point, but it's not just about bikes. It is, of course, it's about livability, inclusivity, prosperity, and all the things that getting more people cycling can do for your city in terms of making it a better place. So I'm very lucky now, to work for the Dutch Cycling Embassy. I'm coming up on 6 years with this fantastic organization, having relocated from Vancouver to Delft in February of 2019, and just recently became a citizen of the Netherlands and of the European Union, which is also one of those kind of very exciting pinch me moments. And I get to continue this advocacy work through my day job, ostensibly working with cities around the world, filling them with information and inspiration from what I consider to be one of the most livable, countries, at least in terms of their built environments and the lessons that those places can take and from the process this country went through over 50 years, because it was not a given and it was not an overnight sensation. It was a series of infrastructure and policy decisions that they made, and to help cities now learn from that process and to implement these changes on their own streets and travel the world while doing so. And so I feel very lucky to get paid to do what I do, and obviously I continue to share what I can on social media through the books that Melissa and I have written to help others learn from that process and be inspired from that process as well.
How do you find it when you're in these other cities? Because I always find that, like, when you get people talking about the Netherlands, or specifically Amsterdam, because they always jump to the city, about here's how it works, and people try and tell the story of Amsterdam wasn't always a cycling utopia. It was a very car-choked city for a long time. People always go, oh, we can't be the Netherlands. We don't want to be the Netherlands. We can't be Amsterdam. How do you find that in terms of porting some of the best practices of what works to make it work in other cities?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's maybe one advantage I have as a non-Dutch person is I do have that kind of outsider's perspective and a recognition of the actual challenges and the differences in other cities, you're not going to copy and paste Amsterdam onto the streets of Toronto or Sydney or Manila. Our message is always, you know, you don't want to copy and paste Amsterdam, but learn from the process that they went through what can be translated and adapted to your own context. You shouldn't outright dismiss ideas that come from a place that isn't a like for like match of your city. I think, yeah, it is. It's not about making cities like Amsterdam. It's making them better versions of themselves and learning just basic best practices. And they can take the ones they want to utilize. They can ignore the ones they don't. But it's really about skipping the mistakes the Netherlands made over those decades, skipping straight to the stuff that works. And of course, creating a context-specific approach to what you've, the reality you have on your own streets. So it's not like you should be more like Amsterdam. It's you should be a better version of Toronto, Sydney, or Manila.
There's an interesting thing of, like, I find this, like, having lived in London, that cyclists, like, the impression of a cyclist is often a middle-aged man in lycra shouting at pedestrians or a car that's got too close to them. But if you actually, like, the thing that the Dutch do really well is kind of like getting on a bike is kind of like just putting your shoes on. It's not about, like, racing to get from A to B as fast as possible. It's not necessarily about the attire that you're wearing. It's more just like the bike is this tool to, like, get around. And I feel like that's, to me, is almost like the weirdest cultural shift that people, having just moved from Toronto, that's what people in Toronto really, really struggle with, is a bike can be something with, like, higher handlebars. A bike can be electric. A bike can have a toddler in sitting on the back of it. Getting over that hump is maybe the hardest piece.
Yeah. And it's a chicken and egg situation, right? Like, the culture is shaped by the infrastructure and vice versa. And the reality is, because cities have not built any cycling infrastructure for such a long period of time, cycling for transportation has all but disappeared off of their streets. And so we're trying to bring it back from the point of extinction through the stimulation of infrastructure, culture, and institutional change. But it does require kind of not just a change to the streets, but changes to hearts and minds and behaviors. And people, if they can't see something as being a possibility, and they certainly aren't seeing every day cycling in regular clothes to the grocery store or to school or, you know, for transportation on their own streets yet, then you do have to show them what's possible through other means. And that was kind of got to the heart of what we were doing in Vancouver all those years ago, was trying to create imagery and ideas to encourage that type of everyday cycling. Because all you could see on the streets of Vancouver when they first started building the bike lanes was punched and helmeted sport and recreational cyclists, giving this idea that it's for sport and speed the idea of getting on an upright step through bicycle and gliding along at a walking pace without any special gear or equipment is quite foreign and understandably so to a lot of people, and so we have to show the possibilities. And that's also, you know, the great thing about bringing groups of decision makers and traveling to the Netherlands. we can share all the photos and videos on social media, but if they can see what everyday transportation cycling looks like in person, that really creates this kind of light bulb moment to say, hey, that could work on our streets if we just makes it sound so easy. But we do have to shift not only the engineering portion of it, but also the cultural as well.
What's the thing that you kind of notice more than anything else when these people come to the Netherlands and they go and experience that? What are the things that they're maybe more surprised by or enlightened by that the Dutch do differently? So it's not just about a bike lane that gets inhabited by a mammal.
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, I think, and Melissa and our family, our first few days in the Netherlands, when we traveled here in 2016, it was just about wrapping our heads around the scale and scope of it all. You know, you step outside of a train station and there's thousands and thousands of parked bicycles and there's traffic cycling congestion on the cycle paths. But to me, I think a lot of people's big takeaway is just how effortless it all feels. It's when you get the engineering and the user experience design down and get it right, getting on a bike becomes mundane. It becomes unremarkable. People do it, you know, as straightforward as they would putting on their pair of shoes and going for a walk. And they will ride side by side with a friend and have a conversation or hold hands or drink a cup of coffee or eat a sandwich while they're riding a bike. They'll carry an ironing board or a case of beer on their bicycle just to see what life on two wheels looks like, but also what it sounds like and what it smells like and what it tastes like. Like just the experience of being in a livable city, and then that word gets thrown around so much. What is a livable city? Well, in the Dutch context, I think it means, you know, a city where the automobile is a guest, and so it doesn't dominate the streets, doesn't dominate people's feelings of comfort and safety. You can hear the sounds of the city. Your senses are really engaged. It's a social environment where you're making eye contact with your fellow road users, and everybody can use a street using any mobility device that they choose. And it's just really about, at the end of the day, reducing the dominance of the car in the urban environment. And that's, I think, people just get inspired by that possibility. The Netherlands feels, well, yeah, utopian in a lot of ways, but it also shows them the end game of what they're fighting for, what they're working towards, what is possible with the right political commitment and leadership. And so the real impact, I think, on the study visits that we do is definitely with the decision makers and at the political level to see that light bulb moment where they kind of are processing in real time while cycling through a city like Delft or Utrecht or Amsterdam. Hey, my city could be a little bit more like this, a little bit more inclusive and livable and prosperous. We could see children cycling and the elderly cycling and have more space in the city for people rather than cars if we make the right decisions too, and knowing that it's not an overnight process, it's not an easy process, it does take commitment, but I think that commitment starts with seeing the end game and creating a roadmap of how you get there. And that's the privilege I have, is to kind of show that off on a regular basis to quite high level decision makers, including mayors and executives, directors of departments, and so on and so forth.
How often do those senior people, like, do they go away going, we can do this? Or do many of them go, that was lovely, but I can't do this back home? Like, what does the sort of the next step look like for them?
It really depends on the person. And I'd be lying if I said everybody that we bring through Dutch City does a complete hallelujah moment and changes everything. But I think, you know, what we do see is, again, they just, have a new commitment. You're creating political capital almost insofar as letting them understand that this is the right thing to do. This is, a situation where everybody benefits. All those bad faith arguments you hear about creating bike lanes and traffic calming, about emergency services, about the elderly and people with disabilities being trapped in their homes and so on and so forth, they're all absolute nonsense. And I think, you know, you can't, influence is such a hard thing to measure and inspiration, but One thing we do see is with the cities that that do come here, they suddenly open to new possibilities. They do see it and they believe it. And that is the start of creating the political capital that really does need some technical support and some policy and infrastructure and so on and so forth. But really, the start is identifying the champions and getting them to commit to getting the process rolling. Because as the famous saying goes, you eat an elephant one bite at a time or something like that. So it's intimidating and it's really, you know, will take a long period of time. It's literally a decades long, multi-generational process. But the first step is often the hardest, but also the most important one.
I feel like there's a thing of people who, or places that have done really amazing things in developing infrastructure. Most of them have done it by, let's do this piece, and then we can do another piece, and then we can do another piece, and they do it in a sort of consistent cadence. And that tends to work quite well. And I've talked about this before with French high-speed trains, like the TGV is a bit more, and it's a like big bang, like we're going to do this network, and then you start cutting and trimming it back, kind of like the Brits do with theirs. I guess the same sort of applies to bike lanes of like, you can't do it all at once, but if you get some bike lanes in, then you get some bike parking in, and the culture starts to change, and then it's all cumulative rather than step one, get started rather than anything else.
Yeah. And this is the story we tell in the books that we've written and the presentations that we give. You know, the trial and error process in the Netherlands in the 70s and 80s stumbled across this exact truth, is that one bike lane at a time, peeling off the proverbial band-aid as slowly as possible, is not going to get you the ridership and the success that you need. You need to start out with a plan for a complete cohesive network, and you need to build it ostensibly as quick as you can. Delft was the first city to do so in the early 1980s, but this really became the blueprint for cities across the Netherlands to build out their own networks using the same principles, best practices, connecting all the places where people live, work, shop, go to school, catch public transport, visit friends, et cetera, et cetera. And unfortunately, we still see elsewhere this idea of just building slowly, one route at a time in response to specific incidents and opportunities, and then taking two steps forward and one step back. And you're never going to get that network effect of mass ridership until you connect all of those origins and destinations in your city, whether it's walking, cycling, public transport, car. And this is the thing, is we've built complete car networks in our cities so that every motorist can access every house, every shop, every office in the entire city. We're just seemingly hesitant to do so. And the cities that have really succeeded in growing ridership from virtually nothing to mass numbers, the Sevilles, the Calgarys, the Vilniuses of the world, they really focused on this network-based approach. And they didn't build their network overnight, but as quickly as they possibly could, starting out with an initial plan, prioritizing which corridors they wanted to build and how they would do so budgetarily. And yeah, seeing the results in terms of city building, it's almost instantaneous, but it's still quite a revolutionary approach, I think, in a lot of places, because they're still stuck in this piecemeal process, kind of grafting bike lanes onto the sides of individual streets rather than thinking about the city much more holistically from a user perspective.
The thing I found amazing about the Netherlands is, like, we all talk about Amsterdam, and like most people who've been to Amsterdam, they've arrived at the station, they've gone through several rings of the canal, they've done the Anne Frank house, they've done the Rijksmuseum, they've had some pancakes and some like bitterball and a beer. But like the more amazing thing is actually when you get further out of that big city and you see how the suburbs are designed around the bicycle, or the train stations are designed around, or maybe not designed around the bicycle, but like the bicycle is a core component of the train stations. That huge parking structure that they put underneath the water at Amsterdam Station. Like, to me, it's like those pieces of, in North America, we're still having the conversation about bike lanes, but actually like it's fitting them into the environment where, if it was a Canadian context, really, if I lived in Mississauga, I should be able to ride to the train station, leave my bike there, get the train into Toronto, and then use a bike share that is integrated into the ticketing system to get me to dinner or the office or whatever it might be. Like, that I don't feel like when we talk about bikes, we end up like shouting about bike lanes and how this bike lane takes away a lane for cars and whatnot. And it's not necessarily thinking about the holistic, what am I trying to do, where I'm trying to get to and from. I think that's the thing that the Netherlands does amazingly well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it pains me that, you know, the vast majority of people that visit the Netherlands seldom leave within 500 meters of Central Station in Amsterdam. So they get the exact experience you described, when I'm always, and I will encourage your listeners now, get the heck out of Amsterdam and try to see as much of the country as you can. And it's also not helpful that people refer to individual Dutch cities like in isolation. One thing we're always encouraging them to do is think of the Randstad, which is the metropolitan area in and around Amsterdam, which is dozens of municipalities, this polycentric megacity, ostensibly, of 10 million people that's interconnected by rail and of course, car, that is kind of, could be a framework for a lot of big cities around the world, where from a user perspective, you know, I live quite comfortably without a car. And on any given day, I live in Delft, go to the office in Utrecht, visit friends in Amsterdam, go to a concert in Rotterdam, and then go shopping in The Hague. It's just, it's all so well connected by cycling and public transportation. And it is quite comparable in terms of density and size to London, Paris, San Francisco, and many other kind of metropolitan areas. So the intermodal system here and how it overlaps with the spatial planning, the urban planning, is just really intelligent. And it goes to show that, you know, it's not a car-free society by any stretch of the means, but you can live quite comfortably here if you don't have the privilege or the means to drive the car, through all the alternatives that they've provided, which are quite seamlessly and smartly connected with each other.
You talked about executives coming to visit the Netherlands. And I'm really curious about like how private companies, is that like get involved in making cities better places? Do you find that, is that sort of, what does that look like? Is that like an IKEA coming and being like, well, how do we sell furniture when people ride bikes? Like, what does it look like when private organizations and corporate execs are looking at cycling infrastructure?
Yeah, it's a good question. And the example that really jumps to my mind is probably not one you're expecting, but the Walton family, who own and operate the Walmart Corporation in Bentonville, Arkansas.
As in the people who like make parking lots. That's not who I thought you were going to talk about at all.
Yeah. But they, you know, despite their business model being incredibly car-centric and relying on suburban and exurban customers and development, they are themselves quite progressive in trying to, first and foremost, make Bentonville, where they're headquartered, a cycling destination, and not just for recreational cycling, but they have this goal to improve their cycling commute for employees to 10%. So they're investing a lot in infrastructure and bike loan programs and so on and so forth, because they've seen it's good for their bottom line. It means fewer sick days. It means better productivity. It means, just better health and job satisfaction. But they also have a philanthropic wing, a nonprofit foundation, the Walton Foundation, where they're supporting organizations and across the United States of America to make similar changes. So we did host them for a couple of study visits to the Netherlands in recent years. They're bringing out all different levels of decision makers, and not just from their own organization, but from the cities that they work with. And so it's interesting to see that even the contrast between, like you said, the companies that rely on autocentricity for their business model also recognize that there are economic gains and societal gains to be had by getting more people cycling and making the places where they work more livable and giving people choices to get around. I think that's a good example of corporate leadership. And you know, to be honest, most of the work we do is directly with local governments. But in this case, you know, it's interesting to see the Walton family taking the lead on this topic.
I kind of imagine that they also sell a lot of bicycles. Like for millions of Americans, your first bicycle was probably bought at a Walmart. And it may have been a cheap bicycle made in China, but like that's probably what you learned to ride on. So there's probably something really interesting of like commercially in there for Walmart too. But like that is the last company that I would have thought of as being over there and being into this. When it comes to like how people live, like I feel like if you create a city that is very anchored in cycling, it then changes how you go shopping. It changes how you hang out with friends. And I don't necessarily know if how much of that is like planned or by design, but like, I've noticed it being in Montreal the last few weeks. Like, it can be really cold when people are riding bikes. It's snow. Like, we've had snow, people are riding bikes. You go to, there's a grocery store, this huge Provigo grocery store up the street from me. That massive parking lot in the old railway yards, now sort of turned into shops. Huge parking lot. Still loads of cyclists. And I don't know, there's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing here, but like, at what point does the city start to evolve around the bikes, or do the bikes adapt to the city, or is it a combination of the two? And that sort of fascinates me is, then do you change like what your grocery stores look like? Does it change what your streets look like? So you have different kinds of social interactions,
yeah,
etc.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is fascinating. I think, yeah, one of the things that really changed for us when we moved from Canada to the Netherlands was just the way we shop and consume our groceries. And we did this count when we first moved to Delft that we had something like 56 grocery stores within a 15-minute cycle ride of our house. And then when you get inside the grocery store, of course, yeah, the food is in smaller portions, it's fresher. The jars of salsa here still make us laugh because they're tiny, and you can't buy the big jugs of salsa that we were used to buying in Canada. Of course, I think, you know, it's facile to say that that's just about the cycling culture, but it does mean people are traveling further, shorter distances. They have this privilege of proximity to where they live, work, shop. So they're not doing necessarily big weekly grocery shops, but we almost now stop into an Albert Heijn on a daily basis to pick up whatever we need that day. Yeah, I think the benefits permeate into so many aspects of our lives. And I think it is, of course, consumer driven. So if you've got a significant portion of your customers arriving by bike, then you're going to adapt to that reality and try to give yourself a competitive edge. But I think, the reality is such that entrepreneurs and especially small business owners in general are very risk averse, and they're very, adverse to the change. And they unfortunately become one of the proponents or opponents, to any kind of changes to spatial allocation or disadvantaging of their car, because they still very much, and probably to a point, are correct in assuming that a lot of their customers arrive by car. But what we see time and time again around the world is they overestimate how much of their bottom line is created by car access, and vastly underestimate how many visitors come by public transport. So it's our job, I guess, as professionals, as planners, as communicators, to try and thread that needle and continue that shift, because it is happening in a lot of places. But as we keep coming back to, it's more than just changing the street. It means changing the way that we live, work, and shop.
I know when we started this, we said we wanted to stay positive, but I do want to talk about Toronto briefly, because Toronto has done its thing of, we're going to make the province review bike lanes, we're going to strip bike lanes out, and like, social media, if you're anything, if you have Toronto in the title, it's just noise of people, like pro bike people, anti bike people. It's not a productive argument. But like, I'd love to get your take on cities that, like, it's not all positive out there. It's not all like people are doing these things and it's all getting better. There are places that are regressing. You're a Canadian. Like, what's your take on this?
Yeah. Well, I think it's Newton's third law of physics. Every action has an equal opposite reaction. Unfortunately, you know, the process of change does have backlash. And I think especially now what we're seeing is cities move very quickly during the pandemic. They had a low risk, high potential opportunity to change their streets, to reallocate space, to create new infrastructure, and take space away from the car in an accelerated manner. And I think for every city like Paris, where we see an inspiring success, we're also seeing cities like Toronto and Melbourne that are now removing some of that infrastructure. And it's, you know, in part, it's, I think, members of the community feel like they weren't consulted or brought along, or didn't have input on this decision. But also, I think it is just vested interests digging in their heels and flexing their muscles and really protecting their own interests and the status quo. And in the case of Toronto, you know, from what I gather, it sounds like Doug Ford's inner circle of quite privileged individuals has managed to convince him that this is the wrong move in terms of reallocated space on certain corridors. He has decided this is, a hill that he wants to die on. Yeah, as we said before we went on air, the facts don't seem to matter. All the expert opinions and opposition to this legislation, the simple fact that nobody's ever fixed congestion by giving more fixed cars, it's all unfortunately irrelevant. That feelings are the only thing that matter. And to him, this feels like it's true, or the people around him have convinced him that this is true. And so you have the ability to create, ironically, you know, a small key conservative that would otherwise be for small government and limited interference is now interfering with municipal politics. And this is the unfortunate thing we're seeing in lots of places around the world, including the German government, who, are preventing German cities from creating bike infrastructure, reducing their speed limits out of similar manufactured reasons, protecting the vested interests of, in their case, the automotive industry. It's complete contradiction of values, but it is what it is. And in a context where the provincial government can override the municipalities, there isn't just a critical mass enough of people cycling and opposition to really derail this bill. But hopefully somebody will watch these bike lanes come out and measure it and study it and able to quantify the increase in congestion and pollution and collisions and crashes and injuries and fatalities, because that's going to be inevitable outcome of this process. And this can hopefully serve as a warning sign for other cities around the world that this is, it's backwards, it's antiquated, it's completely wrong thing to do in 2024. But it does go to show that we still live in a post-truth society. As with everything, facts, figures don't matter anymore. All that matters is the stories of politicians tell, and he's got a convincing story to tell. We just need to find ways to make the most of a pretty terrible situation.
There's something interesting around leaders that do the things that are great for bikes tend to get quite a lot of criticism when they do it. So I know in Paris, Anne Hidalgo, when she was doing the initial sort of creating space for bicycles during the pandemic, it was heavily criticized. But by the end of her term, she won again with more votes, if I understand rightly. And in Montreal, the party that's in charge of the city, originally they ran certain districts, and when they were the plateau was doing things around and putting bike lanes in and widening curbs and reducing car flow, etc. People hated them, that they were like kind of villains in their own neighborhood. And then at the end of the term, they won again with an increased majority. I wonder what happens with the likes of the bike villains, of the ones who want to take away the cycling infrastructure. They seem to be really popular. But like, will that mean that later on they end up getting vilified for it when it seems to not work? I don't know, but there's like a leadership thing that is really, really hard in cycling. And I don't know if you've spoken to a lot of these leaders, so I don't know if you've seen sort of certain patterns that have come through it.
Yeah, well, you've touched on the theme and the thesis of Melissa and Mai's third book, which we just delivered to the publisher 2 weeks ago and will be released in the second half of 2025. We, 2 years ago, we were sitting there watching cities around the world transform themselves. And we kind of looked at each other and thought, well, what are a lot of these cities have in common? And of course, it's two that you've identified there. It's Paris and Montreal, but also Barcelona, Tirana, Bogota, many, many other cities. And the short answer was they all had female leadership. They all had women mayors, deputy mayors, ministers of transportation at the helm. And so that really stimulated us to ask ourselves, what is it about women in charge that is breaking through the status quo and recognizing the urgency for change, but also realizing change on their streets? And so we spent the last 2 years kind of digging into that question and actually speaking to Mayor Hidalgo, Mayor Plante, Mayor Lopez, Mayor Clover Moore in Sydney, Mr. Van de Brandt in Brussels, they've all done this amazing transformational work on their streets, reducing car traffic, creating new, not just bike infrastructure, but pedestrian streets, vegetated garden streets, and so on, school streets. And yeah, it's a complex answer, but I think at the end of the day, for a lot of these leaders, it's not about being popular or remaining in power. They got into politics to have an impact. And so finding themselves elected as mayors and ministers set about making that impact as significant and as swift as possible, not so much worried about the popular opinion polls or the risk of being voted out 4 years from now. Now, it also happens, as you've identified, that a lot of these measures are actually quite popular, that we do often mistake opposition, some loud opposition, some well-connected opposition as being representative and statistically, indicative of what the larger community thinks. And as we've seen again and again the world over, that the people actually, they're not out there on social media lobbying for change. They don't have time to go to meetings or community center at their community center. They don't have the connections to lobby for change, but they will give you permission to make their streets safer, to make their city more livable, to give them and everyone around them choices to how to move around the city. They will vote for leaders who do so and will put their neck out a little bit. And so it's not that it's just women that are doing this. There are plenty of other or men that are showing similar leadership, but there's something I think quite about the female experience that we've witnessed and tried to document is that, yeah, they're coming at this from a very different angle. And as you've seen now with Mayor Hidalgo stepping down after two terms, Valerie Plante announcing she's not seeking a third term, they're not going to stick around for the rest of their lives, as we see with a lot of politicians just hanging on to power for the sake of power. They've made their impact. They're willing to step down and make way for new leadership, new energy, new ideas. And this is, you know, of course, what we should be demanding from our elected officials and especially at the municipal level, where the real challenges are being seen and experienced at ground level. So our hope is that this book shines a light on, it's not as simple as saying, as I said, electing more women, but electing leaders that have these qualities around listening to the people, being willing and able to take risks, to make change happen, to display very human qualities like empathy and to build consensuses and coalitions to make change happen, because the world is changing so rapidly and yet our cities, a lot of people want them frozen in amber until the end of time. And the reality is that they do need to adapt to a changing world, but we do get the leadership that ultimately we deserve. And I hope that we can demand more from our elected officials, because the status quo is not working for a lot of
I think it was Paul Kalbflesch when I interviewed him for one of these. He talked about you change the world by changing your cities. And my hope is actually, like, let's take Valerie Plante as an example. My hope is that she's leaving Montreal to then go do it at a higher order of government. Because if you can make that change happen, and I appreciate much of the change that she's delivered was the people in her party around her as well, as a story that's beyond her. But I hope she takes her leadership and then goes and does it at a provincial or a federal level, because if you can do it in a city, you can do it in a country, I'm sure. That I think there's a really, really interesting like reason to be optimistic there. And then the thing I found that when we interviewed you for the series with Bolden Networks and Connected Commute, with Chris and Bichette, we kept on seeing like the people who are creating great customer experiences in transportation, often women. Like it was often like the hypothesis I almost have is like, is there a slightly sexist thing of, we often design for like accessibility needs, but our idea of accessibility needs is somebody in a wheelchair, not somebody who actually might have been out to buy groceries with a toddler. And like both of those situations, you have a slight disability, like accessibility need that isn't necessarily what sort of a stereotypical male planner is doing on paper behind the desk. And I think there's something like really interesting around like, how does that contribute to creating a better experience for everybody, basically?
No, it's an interesting question. And it's, you know, another kind of quality or aspect that we identified was just empathy. The idea of being able to think and live and design outside of your own experience. And it is something that women tend to do much better than men, to put it quite bluntly. And I think in a lot of ways, it does come down to the fact that they are responsible for a lot of the care duties in the household. And this means that they are the ones pushing the stroller down the sidewalk. And the interesting thing about that is, you know, we've been on panel discussions with elected officials that are men, and they kind of share this light bulb moment where everything changed for them the moment they push a stroller. They had a kid and had to push their stroller down the sidewalk. It's great, and that should be celebrated, of course. But the other response to that is, well, should it take you that long to actually think about people that don't look like you? And I mean, the fact of the matter is, we've been designing cities for the economically productive, able-bodied man as the default setting for well over a century, if not several centuries. And I think the more women we get, the more diversity we get, period, end of story, in the urban planning profession, in the transport planning profession, in every profession. Obviously, those diverse perspectives and experiences will inform the choices that we make. So it's not just about getting someone from their house to their office and back again as quickly and as efficiently as possible, creating a city of corridors, basically, to actually creating a city with living rooms and public spaces and places that people want to spend time and money, of course. And as a result, they're much healthier and happier and socially connected and maybe a bit more richer as well. So, yeah, I know it's not rocket science. It is, again, quite a facile suggestion, but we really need to be doing better, because I think that this is another important point, because often when Melissa and I post about gender and urban planning, we get the same responses from a lot of men that we've solved that problem. You know, it's over. We have enough gender parity in this world, and we shouldn't be making a thing about it. But, you know, the statistics, the numbers that we pulled out for the research we did in our book tells a very different story. And while women may be graduating from university in these programs at the same rate as men, they're not necessarily sticking around in these professions for nearly as long. And certainly when it comes to elected officials, while the number that we pulled out was of the 300 largest cities in the world, only 25 of them have female mayors. So we still have a long, long way to go before we can consider this problem solved.
Can we talk about one other accessibility there, which I think is, I can't believe we've gone this long with a bike conversation without getting here, but we talk about the weather. Because this, I'm so bored of the argument, but like, I just want to sort of touch on, you've been to some, like, lots of places around the world where people will say you can't bike in Toronto because it's snowy 6 months of the year, which is not true.
Yeah.
But you can bike in places that are snowy 6 months of the year. You can bike, I've been to the Netherlands maybe 12 times in my life. I've probably spent, I don't know, 50, 60 days in the Netherlands. I've seen more rain than I've seen sunshine. And people ride bikes in the rain. I've been to cities in Spain where they're building bike lanes and it's 40-something degrees and people ride bikes in baking heat. How do we get over this weather argument when it comes to cycling infrastructure? Because to me, like, that is an accessibility challenge that in some ways it's been solved for, but in some ways you designed for it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, the interesting thing about the same people who say we can't cycle in the winter, they're out playing ice hockey on open-air rinks or skiing in the mountains or whatever. So, you know, that disconnect is not in their head. And it's an important point, I think, and I always try to differentiate between the good faith discussions and the bad faith ones. And unfortunately, a lot of people start at this from a place of opposition. They've already decided they don't want change to happen. They don't want their street to change. The status quo works just fine for them. So they're going to reverse engineer any particular reason why. And it takes many different shapes and forms, from weather to messaging people with disabilities, many of whom, you know, they don't know a person with a disability. They just like to use them as a prop to oppose change again. So I'm always careful to find out if this is a good faith discussion or if I'm wasting my time and I'm never actually going to convince that person. But as you've said, there are more than enough examples around the world of cities that have, again, looked at this from a network-based approach. They haven't done it piecemeal. I was just in Vilnius in Lithuania, a country that gets its fair share of snow and ice and winter weather, and 64 kilometers of segregated cycle paths they've built in recent years, and there's plenty of people cycling year-round there. They can just dress for the journey appropriately, and as long as it's maintained, of course, ice and snow is not a problem. Maybe what gets a little bit more difficult, of course, is the other end of the weather spectrum, the heat, humidity, and so on. We have done work in India and Thailand and, yeah, places in the southern United States that get quite hot in the summertime. And that can be much more of a challenge. But with the advent of the e-bike now, there's less physical effort required. And the other piece of this, of course, is just looking more holistically at the green infrastructure in your city, along with the mobility infrastructure. So making sure the cycling routes are under shade trees, which makes a huge difference in terms of the temperature at street level. And with the understanding that you may never get 50% of all people cycling as they do here in the Netherlands, but you could get 10 to 15% quite easily. And it's not weather that's stopping people from cycling. It's safety, it's comfort, it's convenience, it's a lack of infrastructure. And we see from Oulu in Finland to Seville in Spain, where it gets 42 degrees and 40 plus degrees in the summertime. Cities that build and maintain good cycling networks get good numbers of cyclists. So that, as far as I'm concerned, you know, it's a factor, but it's not an excuse not to build the infrastructure anymore.
Yeah. I think the e-bike thing is really interesting because almost there's a cycling community that doesn't like e-bikes. There's a cycling community that loves e-bikes. There's the thing of e-bikes that probably actually get people out of cars, whereas regular bikes might not necessarily do it. For like the first time you ride an e-bike, I was like, this feels so foreign and scary. And the second time I rode an e-bike, I said, this is the best thing ever. There's something really interesting about them. But then I also think you have the haters of cycling will get upset about e-bikes because they associate them with like food couriers. And they end up in this sort of like messy place. But like, This is the interesting riddle to solve for almost, because you get all the arguments crashing together. And then how do you design the space that works for as many people as possible?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, I talk about this all the time, you know, what's interesting about the, you know, flat, compact Netherlands with the place that has a fairly moderate climate, they've really embraced the electric bike more than any other country in the world per capita. And what we've seen here is they're not necessarily a speed enhancer, but they're more of a range extender. The average e-bike journey here is double that of a regular bike. So it gives not just more people with less physical ability the possibility of riding a bike, but people who live further and further out of the city access to the same opportunities. And it's now a third of all the bicycles in the Netherlands. Of the 24 million bikes, 8 million of them are electric assist.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. So they're outselling regular bikes now on an annual basis. But with the caveat that when I say e-bike here in this context, with the way it's regulated by the government, they have to be speed limited to 25 kilometers an hour, and they have to be pedal assist rather than throttle. So there are some strict conditions on what is considered an electric bike. But it's really, for the most part, it's a win-win-win. And you see people of all different ages and abilities riding them all distances. Again, I mean, the most exciting thing for me, of course, is the fact that outside the Netherlands, we've got plenty of hot, hilly, sprawling places where an e-bike is even more of a game changer. But we do have to future-proof our infrastructure to make sure that it does take into consideration that slight differentiations in speed and mass and ability. And if we're going to subsidize billions and billions in electric car infrastructure and subsidizing e-car purchases, we should be also doing the same with electric bikes, because they have a far greater scalability, shall we say.
Yeah.
And of course have all this added benefits of you're still getting physical exercise, you're still getting social connection, you're still getting a great mental health and break and experience. I think a lot more people, well, we see a lot of the jurisdictions that offer these e-bike subsidies, they sell out and are oversubscribed very, very quickly.
A couple of years ago, I was staying in a friend's apartment in Montreal in the Plateau, but I'd driven, I needed the car to like go drive out, and was taking family to the east of Canada. And I couldn't find anyone to park the car because it was all like permit parking everywhere. So I eventually dumped the car, I don't know, a kilometer and a half away from his apartment. And I was supposed to be having dinner with somebody else a kilometer and a half away past his apartment. I was like, oh my God, I'm running late. It was the summer, it was like 37 degrees, high humidity. jumped on like an electric Bixie bike, and then got to where I was going in minutes. And I was just like, this was the best experience. Like cycling through one of the best cities in North America on a dedicated bike lane on an e-bike, and it cost me a couple of bucks. And I wasn't late, and I didn't arrive sweaty or out of breath. It was just like, hang on, that was perfect. And it all came about from like enhancing restrictions on cars, and then like creating the space for bicycles. Yeah. And like, if I could just pop people who like rage about bikes onto this experience, I feel like I would shift them. So, hopefully that's what we can do over the years. And I want to be respectful of your time, Chris. It's lovely to talk to you about these things. I try and end the like wrap up these conversations well by like saying, if I gave you a magic wand to do anything you wanted to do with, to make cities better places, probably around the lens of cycling, what would your magic wand wish command? I still. Wish your command actually be?
Well, I think it often comes back to this discussion we were having about the Randstad, because I think the beauty of being a resident of the Netherlands isn't necessarily just the cycling infrastructure. It is the railway network and what is, for all intents and purposes, a national metro system with the frequency and speed of a regional subway that is nationwide. And we spend a lot of time at the Dutch Cycling Embassy talking about that bike train intermodality. And I really do see it as the kind of, well, it's not just the backbone of the Dutch mobility system, but the game changer when it comes to cities around the world to replacing the car journey, with the understanding that the bicycle still has a range problem. It's not going to replace the car for journeys of 30, 40, 50, 100 kilometers. And public transport still also has a convenience problem. It's not going to compete with the car and pick you up outside your front door and drop you off at your office. If we create this intermodality as they have here in the Netherlands, feeding the cycling infrastructure into a really fast, frequent public transport system, allowing one single card payment through the entire system from the parking to the trains to the shared bikes on the other end of the journey, far more people will leave the car at home and utilize such a system. And when we're talking about, large sprawling metropolitan areas, it really isn't any single mode of transportation that's going to solve their challenges, but a combination of different modes, and making them as seamless as possible, making them as attractive as possible. That's really the key. But the key to that, of course, is getting all these various agencies and organizations and institutions talking to each other and cooperating with each other. And so, to bring it full circle, to answer your question, if I was to wave a magic wand, it would just be to help cities have these, break down those silos and have those interdepartmental and interorganizational conversations. And I think that this is something the Dutch have pioneered. We refer to it as the polder model. It's a method of governance that requires everybody to participate, everybody to talk to one another, everyone to cooperate. And, if we can get the bike planners to talk to the public transport planners, to talk to the land use planners, and so on and so forth, then we can really build a city for everybody. And it's not just these individual organizations that are looking out for their own selfish interests. So I think, bikes and trains are the key to a brighter future. We need to be investing in both at a much greater pace and scale than we currently are, but it does need to be done in parallel with each other, and to make sure that they really do complement each other and just create better places for people to live, work, and play.
I love that it's like just getting over that hump of having an argument, whether like you work in different departments or whether you have different beliefs, but actually just solving the problem. How do we get people to move around? How do we get people to do things in a better, more fun, healthy, and happier way?
Yeah, and I think in a lot of ways it goes against human nature, because I think we're, especially when we've got money on the line, we tend to look out for our own selfish interests. And so in a lot of ways, the public not only the public transport agencies not talk to the active travel planners, but they probably see them as competition, as taking passengers away from them. Which of course is just not just counterproductive, but is completely untrue. And this is the beauty of the intermodal system in the Netherlands, is it actually, the cycling infrastructure feeds more passengers into the system, creates more revenue for the railway company, and it puts more cyclists on the cycle path, the public transportation, puts more cyclists on the cycle path. So there's these win-win scenarios, these virtuous circles that we can create if we just let go of that distrust and that competition and realize we are, at the end of the day, a lot of us are working towards the same goals. We just maybe differ a little bit on how to get there.
Yeah. That's a really nice note to end it on, Chris. Like, we said we were going to be positive. We only went dark very, very briefly about Toronto, and we ended on a good note. So thank you, like, again, for taking the time to talk about this. I know, like, you've had a year of just being all around the world talking about it, and I think you're ready for Christmas. But thanks so much for sharing the story, and keep banging the drum, and we'll make City all sorts of places.
No, I really appreciate it. I do, as you can tell, enjoy talking about this stuff and sharing the work we're doing. And of course, if your listeners want to learn more, they can go to the Dutch Cycling Embassy website or look me up on LinkedIn, or yeah, we're everywhere on the internet, of course.
I'll put links in the article in the show notes, don't worry. Cool. Thanks, man. Thank you so much for listening to another one of these hour-ish long episodes all about trying to help make City become one of the challenges. Before you go, I do need a little bit of help. So I want to get this thing to get out there in the world, get a bit of traction. So do like, share, review it, send it to a friend, plug it on LinkedIn, Twitter, Blue Sky, whichever your social media poison is. Because I hope you've enjoyed listening to it, because you got to this far. And if you're listening to me now, I probably think you did enjoy it. So yes, let's take this thing bigger, broader, further, wider. And once again, thank you for listening, and I'll see you on another episode very, very soon. Cheers. Bye-bye.